This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Troy Davis is scheduled to be executed in Atlanta, Georgia.
Troy Davis's mother was packing the clothes that she was to wear to her son's execution when she got the news of another stay, the third one, this time issued by an 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta.
After 21 years of legal work, attorney Flint Taylor of the People's Law Office got to see his nemesis, the torturer John Burge, arrested in his retirement home in Florida.
It's about time. Burge, who may have been responsible for the torture of hundreds, has remained scot-free. Now, finally, he may be brought to justice.
The terrorist Luis Posada Carriles remains free on the streets of Miami. Today, we'll bring you excerpts from a recent discussion at New York University School of Law on Posada's crimes.
This longtime CIA employee has been coddled by this government and not sent back to Venezuela, where he should be tried for crimes against humanity.
Stay with us.
Michael, there's been a couple of startling updates on Guantanamo, confirming, I think, that the United States tortures people, kept people there illegally, innocent people. What's the word on this?
Well, it's interesting what's going on with Guantanamo now. In some way, you know, the U.S. set up a worldwide detention system, offshore system, incommunicado system, no legal rights at all. And really, the system of the Bush administration is just falling apart right now. And their entire sort of executive runs the world in a lawless way is on fire, the House, and they're putting out brush fires everywhere. So the few we've had in the last week are pretty extraordinary. First, people should separate in their minds military commissions, which are sort of these kangaroo trials for people at Guantanamo, and then just holding people at Guantanamo without any trials. That's where the writ of habeas corpus comes in. Well, in the kangaroo trial aspect, there were recently a couple of developments. One that just happened a few days ago, which was that five of the people charged before military commissions, their charges were withdrawn. All of a sudden, with no explanation, they were withdrawn. And one of those people is Binyan Mohammed. Binyan Mohammed was a person who was tortured in Morocco, was eventually brought to Guantanamo, and confessed supposedly under torture to being one of the people who was active with Padilla in some dirty bomb. And of course, it's all BS, basically. But they withdrew those five charges against them, and they might recharge them. But again, it shows the pressure, first of all, of the torture allegations. And secondly, it came in light of the resignation of not the first, not the second, not the third, not the fourth, but the fifth or the sixth prosecutor of those cases, a guy named Vandenvel. Vandenvel was in charge of those five cases, and he said, I'm not doing this anymore. He says, this is basically a corrupt system. We have lots of evidence that might exonerate these people, and the government isn't letting me turn them over. I'm resigning. These five cases were ones that he was going to prosecute. It's probably related to that. But what it really, the lesson for that is that the government, every time it has to go into a court, and it was going to have to go into court on these cases in the next 2 weeks, tries everything it can to avoid going into court because they have no way to sustain the cases in court.
And on the dirty bomber case with Padilla and now a second defendant, Ashcroft scared the pants off the country, announcing that this guy was going to bring in this radioactive bomb and they were going to detonate it. And this was the kind of terrorism that we faced.
Of course, Padilla's case was the exact same. He was the American citizen put into a cage in the United States. And of course, they never tried him on the dirty bomb case. They never tried him. The only thing they ever tried him on was some other unrelated to that case, so-called terrorism charge. But they kept him incommunicado detention for years. Eventually, when his case on the test the incommunicado detention went to the Supreme Court, they then indicted him down in Miami for a separate charge. So it's the same scenario. Hold people however the president wants, wherever he wants, do whatever you want to them. And then finally, when they get themselves into court, they have to back up, recharge them in some way, or get rid of them. So that's the first thing that happened this week, is they withdrew charges against five people, really, I think, most likely in light of the resignation of the prosecutor who called the system corrupt. The second aspect of military commissions also is interesting. There's been, in 7 years, there's only been one trial. And that's the case of Hamden, the so-called
the driver.
The so-called
driver. They haven't charged the cook yet.
Right, and soon they'll probably get the shoemaker or the tailor. This is what Guantanamo trials have amounted to, getting the service people, I guess. So anyway, Hamden was tried on like the worst kind of charges, you know, conspiracy to commit murder, all this stuff. In a panel of military people, think about this, all military people in Guantanamo. He's convicted, and then they give him a sentence. It's given by everybody, and they give him a sentence of 5 years and 6 months. And of course, he's already done 5 years in Guantanamo, and he gets credit for that. He's serving 6 months, and he'll be out December 31st. He'll be out in a few months. Well, the U.S. government or the Bush administration insists, first of all, and this is the first principle of executive detention, that we can hold people no matter what happens at a trial, even if I'm not guilty at the trial, much less given only a six-month sentence, essentially. So we can hold them forever anyway. They don't want to rely completely on that. So they've now asked to resentence Hamdan to a higher sentence. Very unlikely. I mean, what the military, even those guys, were doing was really slapping the government down. They probably only gave him 5 years and 6 months, the 6 months additional, because they didn't want to totally embarrass the administration by saying, you just tried a case that was completely worthless, which, of course, they did.
It's just extraordinary. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to do military law back in the old days during Vietnam. The famous slogan from a French politician then was, military justice is to justice as military music is to music. We all thought it was a joke because of command influence. And here, the command of the decider isn't that heavy anymore. And these officers under Bush in the Department of Defense, in the Army, are letting these guys go. It's really extraordinary.
No, it is extraordinary. And even when you were talking about the system of military justice in the Vietnam days and was already looked at as essentially a skeleton of civilian justice, this is not even regular military justice.
It's worse, I know.
This is something that's completely under the thumb of the president. When he doesn't like a judge, he gets rid of him. You know, at least in the regular military justice system, there's this so-called professional group of judges, etc. This does not have
They can use hearsay evidence. They can use evidence,
torture evidence.
From torture. And they don't have to turn over exculpatory evidence. And that's why the prosecutors quit.
So they've had a couple of blows on the military commissions, having to withdraw as well as the Hamdan sentence. Going back to the habeas case, which, of course, as our listeners are familiar with, it's taken three times in the Supreme Court to finally get habeas corpus rights for people at Guantanamo. What we always said, and what I say again, is the minute there's hearings on Guantanamo in a federal court, those people, most of them, if not almost all of them, will be released or will be found wanting the government's evidence. And we just saw really the first major illustration of that. The third case in the Supreme Court, which was won in June 2008, is called Boumediene. And it was one of a group of cases that the Center for Constitutional Rights and other lawyers with us litigated that won the right of habeas. So now the Boumediene case is sent back, along with other habeas cases, to the district court. And they're scheduled for a hearing a couple of weeks from now on the charges which were publicly made, and since they were picked up in Bosnia, publicly made that this group of people, six people, picked up in Bosnia, I think some of them were Algerian, I don't recall all of them, that these six people had a conspiracy or a plot to bomb the U.S. embassy in Sarajevo. That was screaming out the headlines. These six people were picked up in Bosnia, despite the fact that they were released by the Bosnian Human Rights Chamber, which said there's no evidence against them. As soon as they left the jail after their release in Bosnia, they were picked up by the U.S. and whisked off. Maybe somewhere on a way station on the way, but to Guantanamo. Their habeas corpus case is now pending. It's scheduled in 2 weeks from now. And of course, as I've always said, the government's going to be scared of these things. So what's the first thing they did? They withdrew all of the charges around the so-called conspiracy to bomb in Sarajevo. So you have to ask yourself, this is what was put out there publicly. What do they have on these guys? I don't know, because what they've done is it's classified what they now have in the other aspects. But here they have this hearing in 2 weeks, and the main charges, the only charges that any of them are familiar with, are gone. So again, it shows how important a court hearing is and how frightened the administration is of a court hearing. And then there's the second thing that's happened down at the habeas corpus hearings, which everybody's heard and we've discussed on this program before, the Uyghurs. Five Uyghurs, as we know, a couple of years ago.
These are Chinese Muslims that were picked up.
Western Chinese Muslims. They were in Afghanistan. They're allegedly from the East Turkmenistan, some kind of liberation movement. The Chinese don't like them. They can't be sent back to China. Even our own government, which picked up probably a total of 22, the Bush administration, they don't say they're innocent, but what they say is they're no longer enemy combatants, which really means there was nothing there to begin with. But of the group of 22, the first five were represented by Sabin Willett, as people remember, as are the next 17, a lawyer in Boston. And that went up to the Court of Appeals of the first five. And before he got to argue the case that they should be released, this was a couple of years ago, the U.S. ships them off to Albania, where they're now sitting in Albania on some kind of asylum, because they couldn't face, the U.S. was unwilling to face a court. The next 17, Sabin Willett, has recently argued in the D.C. district court, again on the habeas cases. The judge, Judge Urbina, said these people have to be released into the United States.
Yeah, that was a great decision.
Pretty amazing decision. Yeah. And Sabin and others have already found homes for them with the Uyghur community in Washington, D.C., et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, the government immediately appealed and recently, just last week, got a stay of Urbina's order ordering them into the United States. So we'll see what happens. It was a 2-1 decision, at least on a stay, waiting for the official argument on November 24th. But Urbina was great. He's the first judge to actually say these people ought to be released and they should be brought into the United States. Yeah. This is a huge, huge thing. So you can really see in all of these cases that the government's position is really falling apart on the fact that the president can do whatever he wants in the so-called war on terror, that he can avoid any court, and that they can hold people simply because the president says hold them.
And the whole fraud, the fear factor, because they stampeded the country with the dirty bomb that's going to radioactive, with the blowing up the embassy, with all the scare stories that Ashcroft used to announce on Letterman's show.
If you look at those cases, just what you said, the Sarajevo bombing, supposed bombing or conspiracy to bomb, as well as the one to bring a dirty bomb to Washington. I mean, apparently complete BS.
Complete BS. We interviewed a physicist who said that if somebody was attempting to carry a dirty bomb into an airport, they'd have to have a 1,600-pound pack lined with lead on their back or they'd kill themselves. No, things like ludicrous.
Yeah, so you look at this and you'd like to say it's the beginning of the end. It's probably the beginning of the beginning, but it's very, very difficult.
Well, you know, both the Defense Department and the Department of State recommended to Bush that they go forward and close Guantanamo, and Bush refused to read their report.
Bush has promised for a few years he would close Guantanamo. Both presidential candidates have said they'd close Guantanamo. My view about these kind of statements are we'll believe it when we see it, and that we have to just keep up the pressure, which we at the center and others have been doing constantly, to really rein in this lawless, lawless executive.
Well, Michael, when you went down to Cuba last week, I said, vaya con Dios, and I think you did. And you came back with some really interesting information. I know you had some meetings down there on the Cuban Five. Can you give us an update on it, please?
Yeah, I went in part, really, to look into the case of the Cuban Five some more. Again, I reread the opinions before I went, and as our listeners may recall, the Cuban Five were five people who were working out of Florida and Miami in particular in efforts to infiltrate the groups that were carrying out various acts against the country of Cuba, particularly Brothers to the Rescue, which was flying into Cuban airspace, dropping leaflets over Havana. The work was essentially to warn Havana regarding what the Brothers to Rescue were up to.
And other terrorist groups that had used Miami as a base.
That's correct. They were actually looking into a lot of the terrorism that was being carried out against Cuba from Miami and Florida in general. As our listeners may know, they were tried in Miami, convicted. The case bounced around in the Court of Appeals for a while, and they eventually got very long sentences. Hernandez got a double life sentence plus extra years. Two others got life sentences and a number of others, and the others very, very long sentences as well.
Yeah, the lightest one was 17 years.
Right, so it's a very, very severe punitive case, obviously caught in the foreign policy of the United States, and it's really its deference to the right-wing part of the Cuban community in Miami and presidential politics. So I've been looking into the legal aspects of the case, and I reread the stuff again. And, you know, when you look at it, it's just a complete outrage. I mean, as our listeners may recall, originally three judges had said this case should never have been tried in Miami. There's no way for a person who the U.S. claims is a Cuban agent or a Cuban espionage agent or a Cuban working with Revolutionary Government of Cuba, there's no way that person get a fair trial in Miami. Those three judges agreed with that. Then it went to the entire circuit court in the 11th Circuit, which is a very conservative court, and they reversed that change of venue and said the venue was okay. The judge took all kinds of precautions, and therefore the convictions were upheld. And then it went up to another three-judge court in the circuit, but really deciding on two issues there. And the decision was 2-1. Again, one of the judges said, I would have changed venue here. But, of course, that was already precluded by the circuit. The other issue was whether or not Hernandez should have been tried for a conspiracy to commit murder. And I'll explain that in a second. There was there was one issue that two of the people won on, and that was they're getting a resentencing on. They had been given life sentence for conspiracy to transmit defense information. The court said that the sentences were under the wrong guidelines and have to be resentenced. But right now, the case really pins on, and those people will be resentenced, the case really pins on whether or not they're going to uphold the conspiracy to commit murder and the venue in the Supreme Court. Of course, the Supreme Court has not taken review yet. The next stage of this case is for the Supreme Court to get a petition from the Cuban Five asking the Supreme Court to look at this case. And in my view of this, particularly on the murder issue, but the venue as well, I would hope the Supreme Court has a look at it. The murder issue was, when you read it, it's just outrageous, because the claim by the U.S. government is, and it's a disputed claim, but it was one that was accepted by the court and everybody else, by the jury apparently, that the brothers to the rescue plane, two of them, were shot down in international waters and not in Cuban airspace. And people have to understand, if they were shot down in Cuban airspace, it would not be considered murder, because Cuba had a right under international law to shoot down planes that enter its airspace. They did not have a right under international law to shoot down planes or at least many would say did not have a right, although some people would argue they were heading into Cuban airspace, but did not have a right to shoot down planes in international waters. I'm pretty convinced from the evidence that this did not take place in international waters. It's 12 miles off of Cuba. There's really not a lot of evidence that the shooting took place in international waters. Be that as it may, it went to trial on the grounds that Hernandez, when he informed the Cubans about Brothers to the Rescue flying to Cuba, that he somehow had a conspiracy to commit murder. And of course, he probably had in his mind, if he even thought they were going to be shot down, and he probably didn't even know that. I'm sure he didn't know that. He didn't know what the Cubans were going to do. He assumed that would happen in Cuban airspace. And if there was a conspiracy to have these planes shot, it was, I'm sure, the most he had was that it would happen in Cuban airspace. And that wouldn't have been murder. It's not a crime. But somehow he was convicted that in his mind, when he sent a message to the Cubans, supposedly, that they would somehow be shot down in international waters, which is absurd, because Cuba, first of all, would never take a chance of wanting to shoot him in international waters. You shoot down a plane from the United States in international waters, that's like an act of war. It's unlikely that a guy sitting in Miami is thinking to himself, oh, Cuba's going to shoot these guys down in international waters. So the conviction for conspiracy to commit murder in international waters is just completely ridiculous and undermined it, and yet, of course, a Miami jury went with it. One of the ironic parts of the opinion, because as I said, it was 2-1, although one judge was in the middle on this issue, he said, look, because this was a jury trial, I'm going to allow the verdict to be upheld on the murder charge. But at the same time, he says that the venue should have been changed away from Miami. So how can the guy with one hand say, I trust the jury, and then on the other hand say the jury shouldn't have been sitting in Miami? So the conspiracy to commit murder charge is bereft, I think, of any evidence. And of course, the venue change should have happened. So a lot in terms of the legal issue is going to depend on whether the Supreme Court takes this case. And I just don't know. I think it's a very strong case. I think it's a strong legal claim on the murder issue as well as on venue. But we'll have to see. Certainly, one thing you can say about the Cubans in this case, and I think it's the thing that when everybody thinks about Cuba, they should also understand, Cuba has not left these guys behind. I mean, if there's anything that's the most moving thing to me about this case, apart from the fact there's five people in jail and some of them have children and their wives aren't allowed to visit, which is incredibly moving, is you go in Cuba, this is a major issue. When you get on the plane at the airport, there's a big sign, beautiful poster of the Cuban Five talking about them and their families, what their backgrounds were. One of them's a poet, one of them's a musician, and there's billboards around Cuba. I mean, they did not simply say, well, you guys, you did this work, and goodbye, we just can't make an issue out of this. They have taken this extremely seriously. And when you talk about solidarity in the world and upholding really what's right, even if there's consequences, I think the Cubans really have done something here.
Yeah, well, these five Cuban freedom fighters have been in the worst prisons in America for 10 years. Maximac prisons, like in Florence, Colorado. Yeah.
And when you think about it, Michael, some of them are doing life, and they if that happens and the U.S. continues to bar their wives, they may never see their wives again. That's incredible to me. That's a serious human rights violation.
Yeah, but the United States does what it wants to, even in allowing terrorists to use South Florida as a base to attack Cuba. That's against the law.
The Cuban Five case, the Brothers to the Rescue, was flying over there all the time, over Havana. When I was there, I asked, how many times did you guys make this known to the United States? They said, not once, not two, not 10, not 15, 21 diplomatic notes to the United States complaining about them allowing the Brothers to the Rescue to take off from some remote airport in Miami or out around Miami, fly over Havana, and come back unimpeded. 21 diplomatic notes complaining before the Cubans finally took action to try and stop
and,
it.
And they told some of the highest levels of the American government that they were going to take action.
That's correct.
The American government knew that. I think they probably wanted to provoke exactly what happened. But the Five compiled a huge dossier on the terrorists in Miami, and they gave that dossier to the American FBI, and they said, please help us stop this. You can't sponsor these attacks against Cuba. It's against the Neutrality Act, for one thing, and you have a duty to not allow this to happen. What did the United States government do? They turned around. They figured out from the dossier that the Cubans had given them which Cubans were there in Miami and furnishing that information. And instead of stopping the terrorist attacks against Cuba, they arrested the Cubans who had supplied them with the information on the terrorists. Yeah. That's the hypocrisy of America's, quote, war on terror.
No, it's a horrendous case in many respects. A horrendous legal case because it was completely biased, set up, prejudiced, unfair verdict in an unfair city. A terrible case looked at historically because the U.S. has allowed these attacks since the 60s on this. A terrible moral case, a terrible human case in terms of the cost, the visits. And then I want you to think about one other thing as we close this segment, is right now there is a push to pardon two terrorists in the United States.
Yeah.
One is Posada, who people may recall was the one that the author, at least, or very involved in the conspiracy to blow up the in 1976, the airliner that killed 70-some Cubans. He's here on an immigration violation, and there's a big push now, of course, to pardon him on the immigration violation as well as anything else. And then there's another man who I believe is in jail now named Arocena, also a man who did terror against Cuba. And there's a push, and as I recall, Lieberman even wrote a letter asking for his pardon. So at the same time as they're convicting and putting into jail for life five people who tried to stop or prevent or alert Cuba and the United States about Brothers to the Rescue and other terrorist groups, and those people are facing life or very long sentences, the U.S. is about to pardon two people who are well-known terrorists.
As listeners know, tonight, Troy Anthony Davis was scheduled to be put to death by lethal injection in Georgia. On Friday, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals halted his execution. This is the third time Davis has received a last-minute stay. The stay is conditional on a couple of factors. The legal team must show that, one, lawyers could not have possibly previously found the new evidence indicating Troy's innocence. And two, the legal team has to show that the new testimony must prove by clear and convincing evidence that no reasonable fact finder would have found Troy Davis guilty. The 11th Circuit has also asked both the prosecution and the defense to address whether Davis can still be executed if the new testimony does prove his innocence, but the testimony could have been found before by his attorneys. As listeners know, Troy Davis has been on death row for a 1989 murder of a Savannah police officer. He was convicted on the basis of witness testimony without any physical evidence. Since then, 7 of the 9 witnesses have recanted, and of the remaining 2, one is the principal alternative suspect, and the other originally told police that he was not able to identify the shooter. Over 300,000 letters from around the globe have flooded the Georgia Board of Pardons and Parole, indicating that people find it unconscionable that a possibly innocent man could be put to death. We go now to co-hosts Michael Ratner and Michael Smith interviewing Amnesty International's Jessica Cohen last week before news of this day.
Jessica Cohen, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
The Troy Davis case has gotten an extraordinary amount of publicity, drawn some major world figures in on the defense against the death penalty. Where is it at right now? Can you give us an update?
Sure. Last Tuesday, the 14th of October, the U.S. Supreme Court After staying Troy Davis's execution the month before, just a couple hours before he was set to be executed, they denied to hear his appeal, his third appeal. And so now he has a new execution date in Georgia of the 27th of October. And the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles has said that they're not going to hold another clemency hearing and are continuing to stand by their decision to deny clemency.
And this has been in the face of a worldwide outpouring of protest. Why do you think there's been so much opposition to what Georgia's trying to do?
Well, the facts in Troy Davis's case are actually quite interesting and raise quite a lot of doubt as to his guilt. First of all, these facts are very easy to understand for a lot of people and make people very weary of allowing this execution to go forward when it seems to be very possible that he did not actually commit the murder.
Well, is it the law in the United States that even if there is evidence of innocence, at a certain point that evidence is not allowed to be brought before a court?
Yes, actually. What's created a lot of these problems that we now see in Choi's case is a 1996 law referred to as AEDPA, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which basically sets limits on when new evidence can be presented to court. And the problem in Choi's case was that he did not have counsel for several of the most important years when these witnesses started to recant their testimonies in his case. And now there have been seven of the nine witnesses, eyewitnesses at trial, have now recanted or contradicted their testimony. And when Troy did finally get a pro bono lawyer to come on board and take down all of these affidavits, because of this AEDPA law, it was too late to present this information, and so therefore no court has actually heard.
He has really now essentially a final day for execution of Monday, October 27th?
He does.
And is there a time on that?
7 p.m.
7 p.m. And is PM, so right Georgia. Now, is there any legal move that is being taken or can be taken between now and 7 p.m. on Monday to save his life?
I believe that the lawyers are looking into some things, but they're really, pretty much all of his appeals have now been exhausted with this last denial of cert at the U.S. Supreme Court.
And so what are you asking people to do before 7 p.m. on Monday?
Well, right now we're asking them to continue contacting the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles. Although they are standing with their decision from last month, they do have the power to step in at any time. And so we want to keep the pressure on those officials in Georgia and really have people continuing to speak up and not allow something that's so unjust to go forward.
How do people contact Georgia officials?
You can go to our website, www.amnestyusa.org/Troy Davis. And there you can take action right there online by sending them a letter. You can also find their address and their fax number if you prefer to fax it yourself. And that's really the best way to just keep those coming in and keep letting them know that, we oppose an execution of someone who might very well be innocent.
Now, on one of our last shows, Dahlia from AI read a very moving letter from Troy Davis. Has he made any other public statements since the denial by the Supreme Court of a hearing?
Not such as that one that I know of. I know he's been in contact with his family and close friends still, as he always has. And I know that letters are continuing to pour into him, and people are more than welcome to write him as well. And they can find contact information again on the website. And he just is so appreciative of all the support. And what's so amazing through all this is really Troy Davis's character and his ability to stay very strong. A lot of that is really because of the support, from people all over the world.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's remarkable. His last letter and just his whole way of being here has been something that I think very few of us could ever sustain.
Yeah.
After the Clinton administration put through the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act back in 1997, I thought and remembered a comment that great civil rights attorney Bill Kunstler said, that a system that won't allow evidence of a person's innocence in front of a court is a decadent system. What are your reflections on that?
Well, I think that it really takes us back to the whole issue of the death penalty itself. And if there are cases such as Troy's where we still have so many questions of their guilt, once we get all the, once his case has been all through the system, do we really want to be, playing with life and death in that kind of situation? With so many exonerations, over 200 now, 130 just exonerated from death row alone, is the death penalty, a system that we want to continue pursuing in this country? I think it's an important question we should be asking ourselves.
Thank you. Jesse Cohn from Amnesty International on the Troy Davis case.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jesse.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Former Chicago Police Commander John Burge was arrested last week near Tampa, Florida, on charges of obstruction of justice and perjury. The 60-year-old retiree was picked up in his Apollo Beach home for allegedly lying about whether he tortured suspects in Chicago decades ago. According to People's Law Office attorney Flint Taylor, torture techniques including electric shocks and dry submarino, suffocating people with bags, were used against over 100 people on the south and west sides of Chicago. Under Seventh Circuit law, if there's a conspiracy to cover up the evidence in a civil case to show fraud, then you can bring the case again. The People's Law Office brought the case in 2005, and the city of Chicago refused to settle the case while pumping hundreds of thousands of dollars into the defense. Flynn Taylor says the city has spent over $10 million in aiding the defense of Commander John Burge. We're joined today by Flint Taylor, attorney at the People's Law Office and a graduate of Brown University and Northwestern University Law School. He's a founding partner of the People's Law Office. Flint, welcome to Law and Disorder. When
well,
I read
you.
In the papers that they went down to Florida and they arrested Burge, and he's up for a number of charges, which you'll tell us about, I couldn't believe it. I mean, this is really something that you've accomplished over the decades, and you've brought this man to justice, and you've brought the whole system of torturing people on the south side of Chicago into the public spotlight. And you have our congratulations, Flint Taylor. Good job.
We could compliment you all day here, Flint. I mean, it's amazing, and it's not just it's no summer soldier effort. So,
but Flint, let's start from the beginning. John Burge, he's in Vietnam. He's trying to get information from the Vietnamese freedom fighters. He's using a telephone device that generates electricity to torture these guys. He gets out of Vietnam. He comes back. He becomes a detective in Chicago. He works out of the South Side, where most black people in Chicago live. Take the story from there.
Well, he then implements the tactics that he learned in Vietnam in Chicago. And he creates a electrical device in a box. He starts to use dry submarino, which is another torture tactic of putting bags, typewriter covers over people's heads to cut off their air supply. They start to use weapons, mock execution types of tactics. And they start to use them against people who are brought in for serious crimes for interrogation in the south side of Chicago.
What year is this?
1973, the first documented case, a man named Anthony Holmes, who's now, after 33 years, out and has been out for several years. It was the first case that's documented with regard to Burge, which is about a year, less than a year after he became a detective. And, of course, he continues to do this, and, of course, he continues to rise within the Chicago Police Department, to shot sergeant, to lieutenant, and ultimately to a commander of an entire, this time as West Side, another very predominantly African-American part of Chicago.
Well, I presume he's rising because he's getting a lot of convictions because he's getting them through torture.
That's right. Well, over these years of working on various cases and doing investigation, we've documented 110 cases of men during a 20-year period from 1973 to 1991 who were tortured by Burge but a gang of detectives and supervisors who worked mostly out of Area 2, and later when Burge went to Area 3, over to Area 3.
Now, Flint, when did you start working on this? When did you first know about it and begin your work?
Well, personally, I started working on it in 1986 or 1987. we got a call from a prisoner who had been convicted of two cases of killing a white cops. And I mean, it was two cops. It was one case. And he had been tortured, and he couldn't get a lawyer to represent him. He brought a pro se case. He was an illiterate guy, first grade education, and he brought a pro se case, and he had heard about the People's Law Office, and he wondered if we'd take the case because it was the right thing to do. And, you know, with some discussion, we decided yes, and the rest is history, as they say. That got us involved in 10 years of litigation for him, which we ultimately won after fighting very hard. And during that 10 years period, we uncovered a tremendous amount of evidence. What's interesting is we got tipped off to the fact it was more than just an isolated incident of extreme police brutality by an anonymous series of letters that came to me from someone who worked with Burge at Area 2. And that led us to other men who had been tortured. And then we started to peel this onion off. Another layer. Here's another case. And as I said, now, some 21 years later, we've documented 110 cases of torture in the station houses under Burge.
And how many people have gotten out of prison as a result of this work?
Well, not enough.
That's a good answer.
There are 25 men still in prison based on tortured confessions.
Flynn, talk about the Chicago City Council and talk about Chicago Mayor Richard Daley Jr. What roles have they played?
Well, the city council, many of the black and progressive members in the last couple of years, partially as a result of a shadow report that was issued by some 200 organizations and individuals here in Chicago, which called for hearings and called for indictments and laid out all of the evidence. They held a couple of hearings at which time a lot of evidence of torture was put on at city council. Many city council members spoke up and talked about how outrageous the torture was. So the city council had a big role in resolving most of the civil torture cases that were pending. There's still one very important civil torture case that the city refuses to settle, the Daryl Cannon case, and they continue to defend Burge. Now, I noticed that when Burge was arraigned in Tampa, a city lawyer was down there, and of course that totally violates all rules, even the rules of this city. But go
on. Lenny Bruce used to say Chicago is so corrupt it's thrilling.
Exactly. But going back to Daley and his surrogate at the time in the 80s, who is now the very notorious state's attorney of Cook County, Richard Devine, if in fact when Daley was state's attorney of Cook County, and Richard Devine was his first assistant in the early 80s, if they had, in fact, prosecuted Burge when they, on a silver platter, were given very strong evidence that Burge was torturing in the Andrew Wilson case. And it wasn't evidence that, you know, by Wilson. It was evidence from the doctor in charge of the hospital at the jail, and it was evidence from the police superintendent. They took it to Daley and Devine and said, here, you handle this. And instead of prosecuting Burge then, they, in fact, covered it up, didn't prosecute, continued to defend Burge, and we had 75 more cases of police torture before he was finally fired.
And then you had $20 million in payouts so far to the victims. You had a $7 million investigation so far, and the end isn't in sight.
There's more to the money spend out. There's been almost $11 million spent to finance the defense of Burge and the city to private lawyers. There's been almost $11 million in pensions paid to Burge and the 25 men who are on the carpet for police torture in the various cases. And, of course, other than the settlements they had to give, they've given nothing to the victims. And there's been no reparations to the men who have no civil claims because their cases were covered up for so long. There's been no treatment for the men who have post-traumatic stress disorder. There's one client of mine who's extremely sick, who's been living on the streets for many years, who was actually one of the major heroes, one of the first witnesses who came forward against Burge and who the city used to get Burge fired. That man is basically wasted away as a homeless man. That stark contradiction between the victims and Burge living on a pension down in Florida with a boat couldn't be more harrowing in terms of its implications.
Tell me about what happened when Burge was brought into Chicago. He's been arraigned in Chicago already?
No, he'll be arraigned on Monday. He was brought into Tampa. Apparently, sealed indictment was returned last Thursday. The U.S. attorney let us know early yesterday morning, as kind of ironically, we were on our way to court in a torture case. So by the time we got to court, it was known that Burge had been arrested, put in the cuffs, and they set a $250,000 bond on him. And I guess apparently he put up that house that he'd bought with taxpayers' money over the years as collateral, and I think he's out now. As I said, the civil lawyers who the city has been funding to defend him hopped on a plane and went down to Tampa to represent him in the bond hearing down there, and he will be brought to court here on Monday, and I expect that there will be a lot of people out there to see about John Burge.
Let me ask about the civil lawyers defending him, because obviously the civil lawyers are defending your lawsuits as well, the lawsuits on behalf of a lot of the tortured and the unlawfully imprisoned. This seems like an obvious conflict for the city to both be representing the torturer as well as trying to protect the city. Has anything happened on that? Has the judges simply allowed this to go forward?
Well, the judges allow it to go forward. What's more significant, I think, is the fact that the city council, every time that we raise the issue of how can you be defending him, what happens is the city rolls out the FOP contract, the union contract, which says that they're required to represent cops in these cases. But there's also an ordinance that says it's discretionary with the mayor, and you can't represent anyone who's been indicted. So we'll see how all of this shakes out. It's been an extremely frustrating situation because the continued defense of Burge in the civil cases not only facilitates all of this cover-up, but it also facilitates Burge's defense now in the criminal case, both directly and indirectly, because Burge's lawyers in the civil cases are going out and trying to discredit and destroy the witnesses that we have of torture, which are also, of course, the U.S. Attorney's witnesses now. So the city is so squarely still on the wrong side of the torture fence, no matter what the mayor and his surrogates have to say about the matter.
Well, Attorney Flint Taylor from the People's Law Office, if you had your druthers, where would you like to see this spin out?
Well, I certainly want to see indictments of all of the cops involved. I'm a realist, and I know that in all likelihood, Daley and Devine won't be criminally indicted, but I would certainly want to see the men from brought out from behind bars, given new hearings, and the ones who have been put in there on false confessions and tortured confessions be exonerated. I'd like to see the men who have gotten nothing out of this be compensated and to get some kind of treatment center where they can get treatment. In a perfect world, I'd like to see Daley and Devine doing a little time, but at the very least, I'd like to see them admit to their wrongdoing and to compensate those have been so completely wronged by all of this.
Flint Taylor, one of the great police misconduct lawyers in the country, after 21 years, finally seeing the beginning of some justice out there in Chicago. Thanks, Flint. Keep up the good work.
Are you all too? Bye now.
Bye-bye.
We go now to hear excerpts from speeches held at Luis Posada Carriles, a tribunal, at New York University Law School. Speakers included Jane Franklin, historian and author, Wayne Smith, senior fellow from the Center for International Policy. We now hear from Ryan Becker, director of the Answer Coalition. Let's have a listen.
We want to thank the National Lawyers Guild and the National Lawyers Guild chapter here at NYU and all the panelists who participated in what is not just an event here in New York City, but an event around the country and around the world to demand justice, which means to demand the extradition of Luis Posada Carriles, and to hold accountable and culpable all of those who have aided, comforted, financed, sheltered, trained all of the anti-Cuban terrorists. Now, just to put it in perspective, in case people might not know, although many here probably do know, since 1959, since the Cuban people committed that egregious crime of trying to take their country back, more than 3,500 Cubans have died as a result of CIA-backed terrorist actions. And the cost to Cuba, the human costs of this economic blockade, are immeasurable. People have tried to quantify it, and maybe some have successfully, but it's been 45, 47 years of using food and medicine as a weapon against the Cuban people, hoping that eventually they will suffer enough so that they will rise up and overthrow their government, which of course has proven to be one more fantasy. The case of Posada is interesting in a number of ways, and I don't want to go over what Jane or Wayne have already talked about. I want to handle it from a slightly different point of view. He came in March 2005. In early April, the Answer Coalition and others, but principally our organization, began a campaign demanding that he be extradited. On April 13th, just a few weeks after he was here, and which time the Bush administration was pretending he wasn't here, even though he had filed an asylum request, which would require that you be here. We had a press conference in Miami with progressive Cuban Americans and those who thought the blockade of their country was a criminal offense and who distanced themselves from this kind of terrorist activity. And we had another press conference in Washington, D.C., and we began a campaign which, within a few weeks, gained 60,000 people sending letters from all over the country demanding the extradition. This case was completely invisible to the public. It was only really because of a grassroots, progressive effort that the visibility of the case started to manifest. That's important for us to think about when we think about what's coming next. Like, Wayne wants to bet that he won't be extradited to Venezuela. And that's a pretty good bet, given the nature of the U.S. government and the U.S. position. The Answer Coalition would bet you 1,000 shares of our recently acquired Lehman stock, which is worth 9 cents. But even with that paltry bet, we would have to assume that you're probably right, that the orientation of the U.S. government, which is so decidedly against the Cuban Revolution and against the revolutionary process in Venezuela, doesn't want justice for Posada Carriles. But that's the test. That's the battle. Will the people of this country, who have a government that speaks in our name but without our consent, will we carry out the mobilization and the organization and the education to shine a bright light on this case and to expose the double standard, the obvious double standard, the hypocrisy, the lying of the Bush administration or any other administration that should come forward and continue the same policy? On April 13th, we had that press conference announcing these names. On May 13th, we had another press conference announcing that we had now had 75,000 people sending letters. That day, Roger Noriega, representing the State Department, came forward and said, well, we don't even know if Posada is here. That was right after our press conference, which I think you spoke at, Wayne, in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club that was covered by CNN and C-SPAN. On May 17th, the Cuban government and Cuban mass organizations organized a demonstration of 1 million people in Havana demanding the extradition of Posada. And it was that day that the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, and other mainstream corporate-owned media also exposed the fact that continuing to harbor Posada Carriles without indicting him or without extraditing him put in sharp relief the Bush administration's so-called proclaimed position that they who harbor a terrorist are in fact terrorists themselves. And that was then that Posada had his press conference at that warehouse in Miami, because I think the noose was actually tightening because of organization and mobilization in Cuba, in the United States, and indeed internationally, because what we were doing here was being replicated in countries around the world. And so Posada, I think, perhaps knew he was about to be arrested and held his bravado press conference anyway in the warehouse. And then, even then, he put stipulations. He told the New York Times and the other mainstream media, you can come to the press conference, but only if you agree not to ask certain questions. So, I mean, he was just so in their face that even the New York Times, a traditionally spineless newspaper when it comes to these kind of matters, actually decided not to send a reporter to the press conference. And so he was arrested coming out of the warehouse. That's when they arrested him. And as Wayne pointed out, they didn't handcuff him. They put him on a golf cart. Matter of fact, they were fearing that he was cold, so they put earmuffs on him. And then they took him to El Paso, and again, as Wayne pointed out and Jane pointed out, charged him not with the destruction of a civilian airliner in mid-flight. And we should remember, yesterday is the anniversary, October 6, 1976. This is the anniversary where these 73 human beings who thought they were flying back to their homeland or flying for tourist things were just blown up by two bombs. He wasn't charged with that. He was charged with lying on his form about how he got into the country, immigration. So then there was a hearing on June 5th in El Paso. And I'm mentioning it again, even though Wayne mentioned it, because there's another dynamic. The Board of Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security, was so for Posada that when we brought the relatives, the sisters of Raymond Persaud, who was one of those 73 who was blown to bits, a Guyanese national who was blown up that day on October 6, 1976, we brought the sisters into the courtroom so that they could look at Posada and so that the media could see the human cost of this bombing, so that it wasn't just cold statistics or an arcane debate about foreign policy. The Board of Homeland Security deprived those sisters of entering the courthouse. I mean, just think of what Cuba even today represents when we see, when there's kind of hurricane consciousness in the United States and people can see, well, all these scores of people died in Galveston. Or in Katrina, more than 1,000, the poor, the African American, the working class left on rooftops. And yet Cuba, day in and day out, confronting as a poor country, as an island nation with limited resources, a blockaded country, seemingly able to avoid casualties in almost every hurricane, except a limited number in the recent hurricane. That's a powerful example. A country that can provide health care in spite of the blockade for each and every one of its people. That's a powerful example. If Cuba can do it, we in Brazil can do it, or Argentina, or Mexico, or in the United States. A country that has housing as a right rather than for profit. That's a subversive thought in the United States, according to the conventional wisdom by the powers that be. 500,000 homes were damaged and 100,000 destroyed, flattened by Gustav and Ike. And the Cuban government takes trucks with roofing material and construction material and drives to the homes of families that the homes have either been damaged or badly damaged or even destroyed. And they survey it with the family. And then immediately the material is taken from the truck and repairs are made. There's not a discussion about when are you going to pay this? What's your credit? It's like meeting the needs of people because people need housing, a government that's actually organized to meet human needs. In Ohio, 67,000 people lost their homes in the last 6 months, not because of a tornado or of a hurricane, but they couldn't pay enough interest to the same banks that they're now bailing out with the $700 billion bailout. That doesn't exist in Cuba. Cuba is a different social system, organized on a different basis to actually meet and defend the needs of all of the individuals in society. In America, with such a significance attached to the individual, it's only certain individuals who seem to matter. Henry Paulson, who's worth $700 million personally, appoints this former CEO of Goldman Sachs to monitor a fund worth $700 billion of our tax dollars to bail out the richest bankers. And they're telling us now, get ready, you're not going to have money for schools, you're not going to have money for healthcare, or housing, or all these other things. In other words, Cuba represents a different way to organize society. This anti-communism which has become the unofficial religion of the United States for the past 50 years, is a religion which requires each and every administration to genuflect before it. And even those who perhaps may want to change the policy in Cuba have to start each sentence, if they were to even suggest the change in U.S. policy, by saying, of course, the Cuban people need to be free. We need to transition to democracy. We need a new government. We need, you know, no, the Cuban people don't need a new government or a new social system. They need to be left alone. They need to be traded with. They needed to be treated like good neighbors, which they are. They needed to be treated as something other than a target country whose people can be subjected to one after another terrorist attack. And on that basis, the Cuban people and their social system would thrive greatly. It would thrive greatly. It would become a model. Doesn't mean everything in Cuba is perfect, but it means it's based on a different level of social organization. It means that the Cubans have been able to be independent and organizing society to meet the needs of the many rather than the needs of the few. A dangerous, dangerous idea. And so they employed bombs and guns and bullets and missiles and planes and invading armies to stop this process from succeeding. When Luis Posada Carrillo said they were sharpening their machetes last May 2nd in Miami, that's a euphemism. They're not machetes. They're bombs. They're bombs planted in hotels and on civilian airliners. Incidents and deeds that are rejected by most people in the United States. But this truth and this knowledge has been concealed from them because the corporate-dominated media has not told the truth about what this struggle is all about. As we go forward, and we hope someday to win the bet and extradite Posada Carriles to Venezuela to stand trial for his crimes against humanity and to indict the Bush family for its crimes, and all of the other sectors of the U.S. banking and corporate establishment, not just Republicans, but Democrats as well, who have maintained this policy, we also believe and must believe that we, the people of the United States, can be the ones to make real change. If it doesn't come from us, it won't happen. But if we move, if we mobilize, there is no power greater than the power of the people. Thank you.
That was Brian Becker speaking at Luis Posada Carriles, a tribunal. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.